I'd like to introduce our speaker today, who will speak until 10:10 and then answer any questions from the audience. Let's all welcome
Neil.
All right, Neil. Good to see you, Neil.
Hi, everybody. My name is Neil, and I am an alcoholic. And I'm happy to be here. I want to thank Mary for asking me. It's payback. I asked her to speak at my meeting, and I get to speak at yours. My meeting was at night. So, you know, you didn't have to wake up at 6 in the morning to get ready. But anyway, it's good to be here. I'm glad I'm sober. Welcome. I'm sorry about your loss. Life is in session. I don't know what you're going to get today because it's too early to know. So sit back and relax. I guess I'm supposed to tell you what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like today. So we'll try that. Anyway, I'm an alcoholic. I think I was an alcoholic before I drank, but I didn't know, and I think I'm an alcoholic after I drank. Now, I caught alcoholism here in Alcoholics Anonymous. Before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was just a thirsty girl. I liked to drink. I was at a meeting last night, and I heard the speaker share about when he was growing up. When he was a kid, he had the ism, the I, self, and me. And I think when I was growing up, I had the I, self, and me. And I think when you're a kid, you know, you're selfish and you're self-centered, you know, and it's all about you when you're a kid. It's a problem when you're 40 and it's still all about you. I mean, I don't know what to say about my childhood except that it lasted until I was 40. And, you know, I grew up, I had a mom and a dad. My mom liked to drink champagne. She liked to drink champagne at 6 o'clock every night. She liked to drink the kind of champagne that comes with a plastic cork. And my dad was a rager. So, you know, life would be going along really great, and then 6 o'clock would come, and mom would have to have her champagne, and dad would have to get it, and then a fight would break out, and all hell would break loose, you know. And that's how it was, you know. That's not why I'm an alcoholic, but that's what it was like at my house. Lots of fights, lots of rage, lots of rugs being pulled underneath. And I was like a smart-ass kid, always in trouble. You know, in high school, I discovered alcohol and other things. And, you know, I drank to fit in. And I smoked pot to fit in. And I guess I wanted to fit in. You know, everybody, you hear a lot in Alcoholics Anonymous how everyone felt different. You know, growing up, they felt different. They felt strange. I felt different, and I felt strange, too. And it was because I liked boys. And when I was growing up in the early 70s, you weren't supposed to like boys. Now, nobody ever told me that if you're a boy, you're not supposed to like boys. But I got the message. So, I mean, when I was in high school, you know, I tried to fit in. And there were jocks, and there were nerds, and there were, like, these pothead dirtballs. So, well, I chose those guys. Now, one of the things that that I always wanted, and I still want today, is I always wanted people to like me, and I always wanted to feel like I was loved. And no matter how much my parents loved me, and they did love me, and no matter how much they gave me, and they gave me a lot, and no matter how much attention I got, and I got a lot of attention, it just didn't penetrate. It just didn't come into my heart. I just didn't get it. So I went through life trying to make you like me, trying to fit in, trying to get your love, trying to wrest it from you. I remember there was a kid, Danny Zeno, when I was growing up in elementary school. He was so cute. He had a leather jacket. And I loved this kid. And to get his attention and to get him to love me, I stole my dad's trains, his Lionel trains, and I would give those chains to him so he would play with me and love me. And I remember when I was in junior high and high school, I wanted all the kids to be my friends, so I became the pot dealer. You know, if you're the pot dealer, everybody comes and talks to you. You know? And I remember in junior high, hanging out with all my friends in Little League and not feeling good enough and not feeling, you know, like a good Little League. I was the type of Little League player that ducked when the ball came. doesn't really work out. So, but to get people to like me, you know, I would go upstairs into my father's coin collection and steal his coins and take them to the coin shop, liquidate them, and buy all my friends ice cream. And you know, that kind of behavior, getting you to like me, trying to win your love, paying for your love, lying for your love, buying drinks for your love, trying to get love, that's what came into Alcoholics Anonymous. Okay, that's the type of person. I don't know where that came from, you know, but there was a disconnect. You say you love me. I want you to say you love me. Tell me you love me. And when you do, I don't feel it. I don't get it. I just don't get it. And, you know, I drank during high school. I smoked pot during high school. There was nothing wrong with that. That's what we did, okay? If you told me at age 19 I had a drinking problem, I would have laughed, you know? I went through college, you know, I got a Bachelor of Fine Arts. What really happened in college? You know, I was drunk in college, all through college, all through college. In fact, how I got into college, I stole all my high school art professor's artwork and used that as my portfolio to get into college. Because I had heard that this school, there were a lot of gay people there, and they did a lot of drugs. So I had to go to that school. And I did what it took to get to that school. After I left college, I moved to Brooklyn, New York, and I took my first hostage. It was a one-night stand that lasted for 7.5 years. And, you know, that was my relationship. And he was a normal drinker. And that bothered me. And I remember I had this job in New York in the 80s. I had a job at this place called Dean and DeLuca. And it was this very expensive, very hoity-toity gourmet shop. And they just opened their new shop, and it was down in Soho. And it was Christmas around that time. And it was very busy, very stressful. And I remember going into the Spring Street Saloon down the block, and I remember sitting down and ordering a martini and knocking that back, and then ordering another martini and knocking that back, and then ordering the third martini, and this, like, my shoulders just like, the third martini, Then I had my fourth martini and fell off the stool. You know, Scott Redmond used to talk about going in and getting an operation and how he got the anesthesia, and how when you go and you get the anesthesia, the anesthesiologist says, you know, I want you to count back from 100. So it's 199, you're out. Yeah. Scott Redmond's like, I live for 99. You know, and I get that. I lived for 99. And you know, it's not that my life was horrible. I mean, I did not drink to escape feelings. I love feelings. You know, when I drank, my feelings were heightened, and it was all about my feelings. I was going to tell you about my feelings. You were going to laugh about my feelings. And it was all feelings all day. You know, that's how it was. I mean, I'm Jewish, and we talk about our feelings. So I had a great time drinking. I had a really great time drinking. And I'm not going to badmouth alcohol in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. I will not do that. Alcohol worked for me. If I go out today and have four martinis, alcohol is going to work again for me today. Okay? Alcohol works. I take a drink and I get out of myself. You know? That's what it's there. I change the way I feel. If I don't want to be here right now, I could take a drink, right? And alcohol will work. Alcohol never stopped working for me. It never did. And that's just my story. But the thing is, what stopped is that I am no longer willing to live that way anymore. What happened for me is, you know, I had a moment of clarity. All the denial melted away. The lights came on in the bar. You know, the lights came on in the bar. I was a bar drinker. I know what it was like when the lights came on. In New York, the lights come on at 4 a.m. But I'm not done drinking at 4 a.m. So what I did was become a cocaine dealer. When you're the cocaine dealer at 4 a.m., they let you stay till 7. And the last 2 years of my drinking, my husband had left me. I actually kicked him out. You know, we had a discussion. I was on the futon. He said, "You know, Neil, these last 9.5 years have been very, very difficult." I said, "You know, Rob, you should have told me 9 years ago." And so that when that relationship ended, what happened for me was they had opened up a gay bar right across the street from my house in Brooklyn. And that is like buying Google at $5 a share. So I waited 6 months before I went into the bar because I didn't want to be like, you know, typical poor me. So I waited 6 months and then I went into the bar. And I got there early, I got a seat, and I used to sit at the door at the bar from 6 o'clock till 7 in the morning. And then I used to sit at the bar from 11 o'clock till 7 in the morning. And then it was from 2 a.m. to 7 in the morning, you see? I would have to put so much energy in the beginning, little energy in, a lot of fun out, right? At the end, a lot of energy in, little fun out, you know? But I didn't recognize that. I thought it was all normal. I thought it was normal to cut up sheets and make them your, like, you know, window curtains. You know, I had a lot of chairs, a lot of tables, you know, just like roaming. I had a lot of TV carts, you know. I had an easel. I was an artist. I had an easel that I hadn't painted in 7 years, but I was the world's greatest painter. And I had an easel and dried up brushes and dried up paints and a couple of canvases around, you know, because, you know, I was delusional. I was a delusional alcoholic, you know. Towards the end of my drinking, I could not work. Listen, I've never been a big champion of work anyway. I once heard in Alcoholics Anonymous that there are two types of people who come to AA. There are people who've lost stuff, and there are people who never had stuff. And I was a never had stuff alcoholic, you know? I got out of college with a Bachelor of Fine Arts degree with no skills as a fine artist. I started working in delis, and I would get a job, lose a job, get a job, lose a job, get a job, lose a job. And that was normal for me, you know? That was normal for me. Anyway, toward the last couple of months of my drinking, I was an around-the-clock drunk. And people used to say, you might be an alcoholic if you drink in the morning, and I never drank in the morning. You know, I came home at 7 a.m., still drinking, so that wasn't the morning, you know? I was still out from last night. But I was an around-the-clock drinker. Like I said, I would start around, at this point, I would start around midnight. I'd go to the bar, drink until 7 o'clock. stop at the bodega and get a six-pack at 7 o'clock in the morning. All the kids were going to junior high school. They were getting their buttered bagels, their bagel and cream cheese, and I was getting a six-pack of Bud and a pack of Newports. And I'd go upstairs, and I'd drink my Budweiser and smoke my Newports, smoke whatever else I'd have, snort whatever I had, and I'd get at the phone and have phone sex for 4 hours. And then I'd crash, and I'd wake up around 6 p.m. I'd walk up the hill to the Park Slope Brewery. I'd have a meatloaf dinner, a glass of beer that was shaking in my hands. I'd go home. I'd watch the news, fall asleep, get up and go to the bar and start it over and over and over and over again. And there was nothing wrong with that. It all seemed normal. I was an artist, a starving artist. On November 27th of 1999, I went out for a slice of pizza underneath the Brooklyn Bridge. And on November 28th, 1999, I wound up in Laguna Beach at a rehab. And that's when my journey began. They did an intervention on me, and what had happened for me was I had a moment of clarity. They said, "Neil, we want you to go to this rehab," and I said yes, you know. And I could have turned around and walked out, you know. And I'm a turnarounder and walker outer. I say no. Can you meet me at the meeting? No. Can you meet me here? No. Can you go to work? No. You know, you know. But I said yes, and I started my journey, and I came out here. Now, when I got here, I was not a vision for you. I was not crazy about Orange County and the Republican Party, and I let you know about that. And I remember going to the Gucci meeting, which is this big meeting down in Laguna Beach. And it's kind of like this. It's a little bit bigger. There's an aisle. And I remember everybody saying, "We care, we care, we care." So I wanted to really see if you care. So I came dressed in little capri jeans, nice little clogs, a blouse, green hair, and a leopard skin purse. And I walked down the aisle, and I found the toughest, butchest ex-con I could, and I sat right next to him, and I said, "Let's see if you care now." But here's what happened. You were all nice to me. You were all nice to me. So no matter what I did and how arrogant I was and how know-it-all I was, you were all nice to me. You know. Now, the desire to stop drinking, you know, first of all, I never had a craving, all right? You know, I don't understand craving. I never had a craving, you know? I would go to the bar, they'd have a drink waiting for me, right? I always just thought I was thirsty. There's a guy called Howard P. Howard P. used to say in his pitch, he used to say, "I never got a craving." And my sponsor said, Howard P.'s sponsor said, "Well, Howard, when you got up in the morning, did you have a drink?" And Howard would say, "Yes, I had a drink." And his sponsor would say, "Well, why did you have a drink in the morning?" He said, "I wanted to." Sponsor said, "Howard, there's a type of drinker who, once they get started, drinks so much, so quickly, that the phenomena of craving doesn't take effect. It just swips right by it, just pass right by it, doesn't have an opportunity to take hold." And that was me. You know, I never had a craving. I thought a craving meant that you, like, walked across the desert dying of thirst. You had to get a drink, you know. And that never happened to me. I got a drink. It ran out. I got another drink. So I never had a craving. So the desire to drink, you know, left me that day that I went to rehab. But it was filled immediately with other desires. And you know, I was self-will run riot in the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I'd like to say I got sober in 1999. I did. I got sober on November 28th, 1999, but I didn't manage to stay sober. On August 20th of 2000, I went back to Brooklyn to show off my newfound sobriety. And I went back to the bars because I was a barb drinker, and I went back to show off and let you see how clean and good and how funny I was. And I saw all these people, and I was clean and good, and I was funny. And I tried to pick up the bartender, and he told me to meet him at his house, and I went down to his house, and he got home late, and I got upset, and I rifled through his tips, and on his tips I found these dollar bills. They were all rolled up. They were used to snort coke. I unrolled them. I licked the dollar bill. My mouth got numb. I called my sponsor. I said, "Aaron, I just licked all these dollar bills that had cocaine residue on them. Am I a newcomer? Don't tell me I'm a newcomer. Don't tell me I'm a newcomer." And he said, "Oh, Neil, don't worry about it. Everybody does that. Just don't drink, and I'll see you when you get home." I landed in Long Beach Airport and got in his Jeep, and the first thing he said was, "Hello, newcomer." So that was my first lame relapse. I had another lame relapse. I did a thing called poppers. Poppers are a chemical that were very big in the 70s. They were actually amyl nitrate. They were used to enhance your sexual experience. I did them. I'm a real theater queen, and I don't mean Broadway. And anyway, I did these poppers. I asked this guy, I said, "You know, can you do poppers in sobriety?" He said to me, "Well, some people could do poppers, some people can't." I heard you could do poppers, I did poppers, I had to re-identify. Finally, in my sobriety, on November 8th, of 2006, I had to go to the dentist. Now, I hate the dentist. I'm terrified of the dentist. So I convinced the dentist to give me a prescription for Valium. And on November 8th, I got this prescription for Valium. I was supposed to take 1 2-milligram Valium the night before to help me sleep, 1 2-milligram Valium an hour before the procedure, and 1 2-milligram Valium after the procedure if I needed it and was still nervous. So I took the one before at night, I took the one before the procedure, and I took the one after the procedure, but not because I needed it, okay? And here's where it gets fun. I remember sitting down and my hand going across to where the Valium was, picking up the Valium, putting it in my mouth, and going, "Let's see what this does." I had absolutely no control and no power, no thought. And this was in 2006. I'd already been here 7 years. So I had to re-identify. So what is that about? So, you know, I had been going to meetings. I've been sponsoring people. I've been reading the book, reading the 12 and 12, working with others, taking commitments. You know, I went out, you know, on licking a dollar bill, came right back in. Went out on poppers, came right back in. Went out on poppers again, came right back in. I mean, you know, I had like a total of like 6 hours out, you know. What is that about? After I took that Valium, I had to re-identify as a newcomer. For those 3 weeks that I had to stand up and say that I was a newcomer, I mean, I was so full of resentment, so angry, so pissed off at all of you. I hated all of you. I mean, I wasn't too fond of you when I got here. And I really hated all of you then. And I remember my third week of doing that, my friend Eric, he got drunk. He really got drunk. He was drinking vodka on his couch, and he got drunk. My friend John said, "Let's go over to Eric and save him, you know, give him a 12-step call." We went over to Eric's, and we gave him a 12-step call. And working with Eric that day, I forgot about how much I hate you. And I was able to get out of myself, and I was able to get back into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Working with Eric saved my life. Now, I was so pissed I thought, you know, where's my higher power? Where's my God and my understanding? Where's the big arm of God that's going to come between me and that drink? I did everything. Where was it? And for 2 years, I held that resentment. From 2006 to 2008, where was my higher power? And I went to my sponsor and I talked to my sponsor about it. He said, maybe your higher power was there to get you back into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous in just 1 hour. Right? I wanted my higher power to stop me from going out. My higher power was there to get me back in. And that was a big lesson for me. And, you know, I never ask why we go out. You know, we drink. I drank because I had a good feeling. I drank because I had a bad feeling. I drank when I wasn't feeling. I drank when I was thirsty. I drank, you know, and I had no idea that the drink took me. The alcoholic life became the only life I knew. I could no longer distinguish between reality and fantasy. That was my problem. You know? And I had a moment of clarity, the denial melted away, and I had to learn a new way to live. I had to learn a way to live. And I never ask why we go out. I prefer to focus on why we're still sober. Why am I still sober? You know? It's a miracle that a guy like me is sober, because I drink. I'm designed to drink. And I got to tell you, my life today, how I am today. So the biggest thing that I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous is that I'm no longer that guy who's going to try to buy your love. Okay? I'm going to suit up and show up and just be a worker among worker here. I still want a lot of attention. I still get it. But I'm no longer that guy who's going to buy your love. The big thing that I learned here, and I'll end with this, is that if I want love, I got to give love. If I want you to be my friend, I got to be your friend. You know? And I never knew that. Okay? I just did not know that. I thought that for you to love me, I had to pay you. That if I wanted something like your friendship, I had to grab it and keep it. I had to take from out here and shove it in here. That's wrong. What I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, when they say a shift, what that means for me is that I learned that if I want your love, I give you my love. And they talk about it in the book, right? We got to give it away to keep it. We got to give it away to keep it in all areas of our life. That's the biggest thing that I learned. So thanks a lot for having me share.